Chapter 63, In the Bardos. Purpose. While the Bardos, meaning an in-between state of awareness, most often describe three specific stages in Buddhist philosophy that one passes through after death, a metaphorical Bardo can represent a time when one's typical life is suspended, as in the face of illness. Duration. Teachings suggest one can pass through a Bardo in a split second, or take up to 49 days to go through the last three. Equipment needed. Ideally, relative comfort with uncomfortable states of mind. Age 35. Relationship status. Super pumped that I just pulled the tower card for my tarot deck. The image of two people jumping out of a flaming castle with their hair on fire looks extremely positive. Around for the house on me. Top shelf. Only the good stuff. Cost. Usually it requires death. It appears I've lucked out. Humiliation factor. Fair to middling. Location. I think I'm currently in the third Bardo, where a feeling of stupidity is the natural outcome of a limited point of view. I've heard it described that the Achilles heel of consciousness is that we forget. I couldn't agree more. I've started to wonder if my consciousness needs support hose. You know those really strong grandma ones? Those hoes. Given that 80% of the brain's function isn't even understood, who am I to say that my most essential thoughts haven't started to pool, potentially drowning in cerebrospinal fluid, or conversing with each other down at my ankles? Maybe with special pantyhose, I can keep all my best knowing right at the top, instead of feeling as if it's wandered off, gone missing, fallen and can't get up. My love affair with Laird is slipping sideways. He feels distant. I overheard my ankles talking. They say, we've been here before. Chapter 64. Attend a reading. Purpose. I want to listen to an articulate person talk about love. Not the way it's been pulverized by advertisers and shallow tales, but the true give-and-take, deep, abiding kind. Duration, an evening, but a certain residue can remain. Equipment needed. Ears. Age, 35. Relationship status. I think I'm trying to turn Laird into someone he's not, i.e., someone ambitious. Cost. Free. Humiliation factor. It's more of a vulnerability factor, and it's high. Location, Village Books, Fairhaven, Washington. When I found out Barry Lopez was reading, I couldn't call Tim fast enough, suggesting I get tickets for him and V. I asked Laird as well, dying for him to be dying to come, like I am, like Tim will be, but he declines. I arrive early, saving seats for the three of us. As they descend the stairs into the cavernous basement, I wave them down like I'm trying to hail a cab in a deluge. V is so petite, I feel like an ogre waving down a fairy princess and her prince, if ogres took cabs. Lopez greets a packed house. The last time Tim and I were both in this room, we were husband and wife. Now we're what? Survivors? Fellow travelers? Friends? A shared memory? The walking wounded, each with opposing or mirror image limps? Lopez begins reading Traveling with Bo Ling, a piece I haven't. It's a love story between a North Vietnamese woman named Bo Ling and a bitter Vietnam veteran named Harvey Fleming. They meet and fall in love in Santa Cruz, decades after the war, both blind from different traumatic injuries. He loses his eyesight and his genitals from the shards of a grenade. She loses her sight when her first husband throws lye in her eyes for looking at another man. They marry. After a few years, Bo Ling asks that they revisit Vietnam, the location of their mutual loss of innocence. She as a survivor of war and abuse, and he as a former enemy soldier in her homeland. Through their shared sightless return, the bitterness begins to wash out of him. While it's literally the blind leading the blind, he credits Bo Ling with opening his eyes, leading him out of his darkness and back into light. He continues to shed himself of his anger enough to find an expression of artistry with his hands, the delicate tradition of origami. Their travels continue to other countries, bridging the gap between what they survived and the very full possibility of what they can still become. I feel this urge to reach out to Tim. I know it is inappropriate, and so I sit with myself, emotion welling up in me for all that may never be said. I have no such experience with the man, nor acknowledgement of the lengths to which I went to get us there. I think of Laird and all I wish for is now, the thoughtful meals, our dogs, the slow living, old Alan Watts recordings in the background at breakfast, the sweet melancholy of the Goldberg variations. And then, as my yearning spirals, I no longer am sure of the face I attach to such desires. The story ends with Bo Ling suggesting they adopt a baby, and Bo Ling assuring her beloved that with the tincture of time, he will have shed sufficient anger to make room in his heart for a child. To wash out the anger, she says, fall in love. Be in love with a peach, she says, its summer juice running down your bare chest. Be in love with the sound of your brother's truck as it pulls up to the curb on a summer night with supper just ready on the table. Be in love with me, she says. Re-engage your innocence here, in the Dresden of my face. By this point, internally, I'm toast. Mushy, super, soggy toast. As people begin to queue for book signing, I rise, feign a smile at Tim and V, and head to purchase more books for signing. But really, it's to gather myself to take a break from this strange threesome. Once sufficiently regrouped, I join the queue. As I wait for my turn with Lopez, I see Tim and V well behind me. I know that Tim places as much meaning on talking to Lopez as I do. What I'm struck by is how Lopez takes genuine, non-rush time with each person. No one is forgotten. When my turn comes, I hand him a stack of books, one for Laird and, of course, one for my mother. I ask for him to inscribe those, too shy to ask him to sign my own. He takes the third book. And what is your name? He asks. Megan, I say quietly. And then I find myself speaking. I've been trying to be someone's Bo Ling. I don't think it's working out. His name is Laird. He's that other book you have there. He smiles at me with sorrow at his edges. Yes, he says, nodding directly. He returns his attention to writing in the third book. I look up at the ceiling, using my sleeve to manage the mascara situation I've created. He looks back up at me. We settle onto one another's faces for a second longer. It's always those last held seconds that seem to mean the most. Thank you, I say, smiling while biting my lip in apology for, I suppose, my vulnerability. I go in search of a chair. From there, I can see the backs of Tim and V. She adjusts his hair with the gesture of the lovers that they are. I imagine her as Tim's Bo Ling. I tip my head back to catch the water in my eyes like a saucer might catch a spill from a teacup. I open my book to the title page, and in a script of thick black cursive, I read what he's written. Megan, not to forget. Unknown to each other, still, we are holding each other in the storm. Oh, it hits right at the center of me. I jump up and head to Tim, rushing like a little girl might, to show her parents what she made at school. But unlike a proud schoolgirl, my melancholy comes too. Look what he wrote in my book, I say. But as I look at them while I speak, I know it's a moment neither Tim, nor I, nor the three of us can linger in together. It's out of step, out of place, out of time. He smiles meekly with a kind but conflicted expression. I take my book back, closing it under my arm. I redirect, looking down at V's strong black boots, and then back up. Another gathering. What story in the collection spoke to you two most? I ask. I'm interested, but mostly I just want out of the tension that's gripping my throat like a vice. Mortis and Tenon. I want to talk to him about Mortis and Tenon, Tim says. I know the story well. A mortise and tenon describes a simple joint in two parts made by woodworkers for thousands of years. The mortise hole and the tenon tongue are carved to fit tightly together so that the mortise can support the shoulders of the tenon's rail, the masculine and feminine joined at 90 degrees. Mortise and Tenon, the story, follows a season with a highly skilled itinerant furniture maker. We meet him in Bangalore as he never chooses to settle in one place. Not because he doesn't love companionship, but because he does not believe himself capable of the kind of reciprocity such intimacy requires. Staying with any one person means he would have to fake the life unfolding in his blind spot. Our woodworker has a haunt. Sexually abused as a child by the betraying hands of a doctor, he, up until this point, considers the fallout of those events no more severe than walking with a light limp. But through violent circumstances in Bangalore, he comes to realize that his old wounds were far more extensive than he'd always told himself. And without dismantling his coping strategy to keep those he most cared for at arm's length, his itinerant life would remain driven by the compulsion to isolate rather than choose a life fully realized. To what extent, and specifically how, did Tim relate to the woodworker? And which struggle within the character, I'm aching to know, compels Tim to speak to Lopez? I can't imagine wanting to know anything more. I think I've had a case of what researchers call cognitive dread, the phenomenon describing how most people would prefer to experience pain immediately, even higher levels of it, rather than sit and wait for it. I think of it more like the waiting for multiple shoes to drop condition. It's not just a curiosity, but a deep haunt of mine about his oldest, deepest haunts. I think back to a time when I asked Tim when or what prompted his increasing use of sex on the phone. He said, "It seemed to really increase when I began my relationship with you. The closer we got, the more it grew." What did that mean? Had our bond somehow brought him too close to an earlier wound? And did that pain or memory, living in close proximity to our intimacy, manifest as phone sex and an arrest? Does knowing more of his particulars even matter? I stand in this cavernous, familiar place and I wonder. I wonder whether the death of our relationship came not from what was withheld, but merely from the withholding, the fatigue, the disillusionment, and perhaps just an unrecoverable distance. That bloody cascade. I don't know. And certainly Tim isn't telling me. Perhaps he will tell Lopez. Find comfort there. And so now, here we are, with our haunts in a basement. I watch as Tim and V approach Lopez, the distance between us growing. I watch Tim lean down to speak in hushed tones with him. I tuck my books into my coat and head for the stairs, out into the rain. Chapter 65. M&M Parts Work Revisited. Shock Talk. Purpose. A way to talk about shock while still in shock. Internal Family Systems Parts Work still makes it easier sometimes to tackle difficult topics. Duration. Acute stage, about 4 days. Equipment needed. Couch. Age, 35. Relationship status. Can I just bow out of all this relationship stuff now? Cost. Hard to measure, but not cheap. Humiliation factor. It's not so much humiliation, well, kinda. More like disillusionment. All over again, but maybe worse. Location, Bellingham, Washington. Hi. I don't know if you remember me. I'm pretty shy, and I mostly ever talk to Maji. But Megan told me she wrote about me, That's kind of embarrassing, because I'm the M&M. Remember all that stuff about parts work? I guess I'm more like a metaphor. I don't think of it like that, though. I think I'm just her most tender part. I take the hardest hits as her most trusting part. Some people call that naive, but I see it like her always try to see the best in people nature. I like my part, her no matter what I want to get it right parts. Well, turns out she kind of got it all wrong, but she kind of got it right too. It's confusing. Here's what I know. I just got kicked, or I should say we did, hard, in the gut. It was a couple of days ago, but I've been curled up with her and Isabel on this couch ever since. It's the only thing that helps. Megan loves this couch, all deep and flowery. She and Tim bought it together. That was a long time ago. But this couch is wide, wider than most, and deep, deeper than most, and warm. So we're staying put, and anyway, it's the weekend. Megan's been helping Tim house hunt, encouraging him to buy. After an afternoon of house hunting, Tim was dropping Megan off at her singing lesson, and I don't know why then, but suddenly she blurted out some questions. It's not like it was the first time for these. This is what I overheard. Megan asked, "Tim, I know I've said this hundreds of times, but I always imagined this turnoff as the spot where it all happened, even though I know it took place much farther south. For some reason, I picture this spot. I always thought in an incredible coincidence that the first time you talked to a prostitute, you got arrested. Was that really true?" And he hesitated. Then Megan asked, "What could possibly happen now? What are we going to do, get a divorce?" Turning away, he took a big pause. "No, it wasn't the first time," he said. "Well, then, how many times were there?" Silence. "Was it more than one?" Silence. "Two?" Silence. "More than two?" "Yes, more than two." So she's like, "Okay, three? Four?" "Yes, more than four." It was like pulling teeth. She got him to 10, yes, more than 10, 20, yes, more than that. Finally, after jumping past 20 to 40, then 50, then 50 got to 60. He paused and said, "I guess I'm comfortable with the number 60. Comfortable with the number 60. She learned later he'd said it was more like 100. He said it started when he was in grad school at Brown. Now, I'm just a World War II candy, but even I'd like to know, where had he found the time? And if he was comfortable saying 100, I wondered if it was like cigarettes, and we should double the amount, make it 200. 200 anonymous faces, 200 motel rooms or back seats, 200 different bodies, 200 made-up stories, 200 cash transactions, 200 extra showers before he came home. Chapter 66, Post-Traumatic Stress Response. Purpose. This isn't so much a therapy I selected, but a therapeutically understood experience that selected me. Duration. Varies. Equipment needed. Case-by-case basis. Age. 35. Relationship status. Who knows? Cost. Adrenaline and other chemicals. Large recruitment of the sympathetic nervous system. Humiliation factor. There's no time for that. Location. Practically any neighborhood north of Mount Vernon, Washington, and south of Vancouver, British Columbia. When trauma takes over, it's hard to keep track. I'm not one of those people who automatically believe things happen in twos or threes or whatever, but within a few weeks of the 101 announcement, after my prompting endless discussions about commitment and how to share the business loan, Laird had moved out. To complete my nauseating style, I should have purchased two cream velour slipper chairs for the bedroom and insist we drone on there. It was not just an all-too-Griswold family-style thing. It also resembled my breakup with Tim, where I got to say I'm not really sure who did it. Both were at my pushing, but then I don't have to own that I started the process. And so, I found myself staring at the television with a nightly dose of gummy bears. When Laird said there wasn't anybody else, I didn't believe him. This time, I listened to my gut. Instead of sitting on that couch thinking about Tim's 100 anything or about my mother losing her mind, I snapped. All I could think about was confirming that Laird wasn't telling the truth. What does snapping look like? Becoming possessed by one solitary thought to the exclusion of all else. Upon rising, in the middle of treating a patient, while making marketing calls, while throwing the ball for Isabel. Snapping looks like having the same thought while walking to buy gummy bears at the Hagen 24-hour grocery store, while driving by Laird's new borrowed apartment, while walking Isabel through Whatcom Falls Park, while waking in the night, while driving by Laird's apartment just one more time, while attempting sleep again, upon rising in the morning, upon eating breakfast. It was the worst kind of loneliness, a crazy loneliness, day in, day out, just this one thought. Is he lying too? 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 Bye-bye, Megan. Hello, nut job. I was concerned that if, God forbid, Laird left town, I was just one jumbo box of Depends away from a nonstop cross-country drive in search of him. I think snapping is possible even with normal people, but it's not normal when it's happening. So this is the part where I show you the very worst in me, the part you aren't supposed to show anybody, because then the jig is up and you've shown that you're just a mess of tangled wires currently without the orderly circuitry of a sane person. But I have this theory that it's precisely the thing we like least about ourselves, the parts we struggle with the most, the parts we are most likely to hide, that are actually the parts that in some strange way most endear us to one another. Here goes. Chapter 67. Freeze your eggs. Purpose. Get my head above water? Stop time. Stop time so I can get my head above water? Duration. The process takes about a month. Freezing appears to last potentially till the end of time. Equipment needed. A lot of hormonal drugs, self-administered shots. Age. 35. Which means my eggs are what? Geriatric? A mere 12,775 days old? Relationship status. Sister-wise and fertility-related, Renee had an easy time getting pregnant. Although she's not big on the details or asking or answering personal questions. She's nesting, which is cool though. Nesting with Kelsey and Rich. And starting to quilt. Cost. $10,000! That's almost a dollar for every day these eggs have been sitting around inside me. Humiliation factor. Asking to borrow money to pay for it will be humiliating. I don't believe in borrowing money. Location. Boston, Massachusetts and Pasadena, California. I'm not doing so well. I'm still growing my practice, but half the time I'd like to crawl onto my acupuncture treatment table and have my client stick one right between my eyes. I like to think I just rolled with the punches with Tim, but maybe I just kept rolling and rolling or spinning like a dreidel. Now I'm concerned my spinning is more like the going down the drain sort of spinning, becoming a big picture caretaker and advocate for my mother, spinning over this man, love, relationship stuff, being a successful business owner who looks to no one but herself. Here's the thing I know. Whatever I'm in, it's going to take me longer to get out from under it than I would like to imagine. Longer than it would take a normal me or a normal person, whoever that is. Longer than that normal, non-blindsided woman would take to meet a nice man again, date, settle into a committed thing, consider marriage or whatever feels right, and then have children together. The spinning. Why did I waste so many fertile years trying to save what I merely hoped I had with Tim? Am I just naive enough to think I can fix any relationship? What am I holding on to with Laird? Our Earthship skinny dip, two-dog, easy-living fantasy? Did I intuitively know about this 100-hooker business? What do I know about Laird that I am not acknowledging? How different is this from thinking I could fix my parents' marriage? What else have I gotten so categorically wrong? For all this spiraling, somewhere in me, I still believe that motherhood and a solid relationship are possible for me, that I can raise children with the deep love of my life. And I will protect that part of me while I try to weather and crawl out of this storm of disillusionment, where the loss of my mother doesn't prevent me from becoming one. And with luck on my side, my mother had me older, and my sister got pregnant easily in her late 30s, maybe this could work. So I'm taking some of my eggs out. I will offer them protection from time. Maybe this way I can still bring even just one into the world. I can do that for me, for them, for the man I hope to meet who also dreams of a family. Once I find the Extend Fertility Clinic and begin the shots, I start talking to my eggs. This is what I tell them, every day, before I rise and before I go to sleep, with my hand on my belly. Listen, guys. Well, technically, I think you are all ladies until the sperm comes along, so listen, little ones. I'm going to try to grow a bunch of you at once, as many as I healthily can. And then once you are all around the same size, a nice doctor is going to go in and take you out. He'll put you to rest for a little while in something that looks like a nice propane tank, but it will be kind of cold, so I'll ask just the hardiest of you to come. Please, eggies, only come if you're up for an adventure. If, down the road, somebody wakes you, thaws you, rehydrates you, please know that something really good must have happened for me to feel it's the right time to bring you into the world. You'll have to trust me on this. Maybe you can think about my waking you like Sleeping Beauty out of her deep, beautiful sleep. Yes, yes, think like that. You are all sleeping little beauties. Just know, I suspect I may be going off the reservation for a while, and I would rather, if possible, shelter you. Why should you have to withstand the squall? Turns out, 11 eggs are up for the journey. They are sleeping deeply in Boston and Pasadena. Thank goodness, 'cause a storm, it's a-comin'. Chapter 68. Spy on Your Ex. Purpose. A defining moment that tells you, in no uncertain terms, that your system's in trouble. It's said that when traumatized, the body can seek out what's familiar, repeat a pattern within a disturbing event. All I know is I'm a woman on a singular mission. And not a reasonable one. Duration. August, a week or so before my birthday, like the night of Tim's arrest. Equipment needed. A spymobile. Cell phone to give Coco the blow-by-blow. Age. Same. Relationship status. I mean, with a chapter heading like Spy on Your Ex, do I really have to spell it out? Cost. The price of gas. Humiliation factor. Fantastical. I hate telling you about it. Location. The Leonard Streets neighborhood, Bellingham, Washington. I am 35 years old, and I am squatting in a bush. Not a small bush, but a rather large one. I have not lost my keys. I have not stumbled and landed here. I am not gardening. I'm hiding. It gets worse. I'm 35 years old, hiding in a bush, and I'm eavesdropping on my non-boyfriend boyfriend and his non-girlfriend girlfriend. For more than 2 years, he'd been my primary relationship. Dogs, dinner time, and morning coffee. And what with my pressing the issue of commitment, he left, but with equivocal words like, I love you, but I need to feel like I can freely choose you. Let's see if something naturally unfolds between us. There's nobody else. And now I am the oh-so uninvited guest hiding across the street in some stranger's yard, straining my ears to listen to their dinner party conversation. My heart is racing. One minute I'm behaving like a young professional, albeit peppered with an above-average breakup disappointment, and seemingly the next I'm Inspector Clouseau. Despite, I might add, Coco's sage advice every step of the way. I wouldn't get out of that car if I were you, as I get out of the car. I wouldn't crawl into that bush, as I drop to my hands and knees while still holding the phone. Well, if you're gonna do it, by all means, turn off your phone because I can't ring you back to tell you to turn off your phone as he will hear the ring from the bush, as I settle into my squat in the shrubbery. I had the literal voice of reason, hers, in my ear and proceeded anyway. And if I had my wits about me, the wisest me, floating omnisciently above my neighborhood antics, would be able to look down and see that Coco isn't just the voice of reason, but a powerful sisterly force of unconditional kindness, forever offering me the rope to pull me out. She, the steady ground to pull me in. And yet I prefer to grasp at a phantom, a ghost, a shadow on the wall. And so now, obstinately remaining in my bushlight cave, my body is crouched in a small ball, and I'm listening as though I'm receiving instructions for how to deactivate a nuclear bomb. This dinner with Miss Nobody Else is none of my business, nor is their conversation even all that interesting. In my imagination, they had been having a far more unbelievable, life-altering, mind-blowing experience than what I was hearing. If I could for a moment overlook the fact that my adrenaline is pumping about 1 million liters a minute, I'm frankly a little bored. In my own defense, spying was never my plan. I was just going to drive by. But one thing led to another, and the next thing I know, I'm shimmying past some garbage cans, hoping I'll be mistaken for an extremely large, blonde raccoon. Maybe hearing the words, "there's nobody else," led my entire system to blow a fuse. As of now, I am hostage to an entirely different set of thoughts. Nobody else my ass. My husband's version of nobody else turned out to be 100 or so somebody else's who, unbeknownst to me, had invaded my vagina by extension. I would not downplay that sinking feeling this time, and this time, it wasn't a low-grade message. It was fully amplified. Maybe this was my desperate attempt to stay connected to Laird, to feel like we were somehow still in a relationship. Also, if I knew where he was, I wouldn't have to confront my own isolation, struggling to accept that in the end, a maybe isn't a yes. The truth, I was 35 and I'd given and changed all that I could for someone who no longer wanted to be with me. And now I was alone. Or maybe I was driven to know what sneaking, hiding, and feeling terrified of getting caught felt like. To be bad and dark and break the rules. Maybe I wanted to travel Tim's terrain and feel that place in me. After a back-numbing hour on my knees, I hear some goodbyes, and the next thing I see is Laird leaving the house in his skateboard sneakers with his kick-a-stone home gate. There's no lingering goodnight kiss. He looks over in my general direction. Oh, God. Did he see me from the streetlight over the shrub? I stay a while longer and pray he doesn't take a wrong turn and stumble onto my car, with Isabel's teddy bear self sitting upright and shotgun on active lookout for my sneaky return. I crawl out. Was I a stalker? I race home to look up the definition of stalking. I ring up Coco to review various definitions. There's a website for everything, so there is a website for how to know if you are being stalked or conversely, if you are a stalker. It appears what I did would be more accurately described as surveillance, as I had no intent to harm, scare, or intimidate. I could live more comfortably with that, far less frightening than stalking. Surveillance sounds rather official, even downright responsible, the harmless gathering of information. Christ, surveillance is requisite in some of our finest institutions, the bedrock of our most heroic crime-solving and whistleblowing, that which makes our great nation great. One could argue this is nothing short of goddamn patriotic. But perhaps, and I can assure you Coco concurs, If you have to split hairs to define whether your behavior is within legal limits, you're in some kind of trouble. Chapter 69, Sex Toys. Purpose: an object used on the body designed to produce pleasurable erotic stimulation. I'm pretty sure when Tim gave me these, it was to bring us closer together. Duration: while I've had them for years, I haven't used them in ages. Equipment needed: the obvious. Less obvious: trash can, trash bag, trash. Age: 35. Relationship status: does grasping count as a relationship? Cost: they were a gift from Tim a million years ago to salvage our sex life. Humiliation factor: come on now, take a guess. Location: my house in Bellingham, Washington. I'm digging through my boyfriend's garbage. I mean my ex-boyfriend Laird's garbage. I mean, technically, it is my garbage because it's my can in my house, but this is his garbage. Laird stayed here to dog-sit Isabel for me while I was out of town. And regarding this averagely intelligent, not hugely handsome, but kind of smoky, sort of lazy person with a quiet life, This guy, the first thing I want to do when I return is search for clues of his presence. I don't understand my own motivation. It doesn't seem right, yet knowing it doesn't seem right in no way prevents me from doing what I'm doing. He's not even all that interesting, and my head knows this, but my paws, they don't care. They have to dig. And the scary thing is, in the whole wide scheme of the human spectrum, even with this, I would still be considered a highly functioning human. I'm one of the together ones. If that doesn't tell you how odd, how bumbling it feels to be a human, I don't know what will. I can't seem to shake him. I don't know why I can't, but I can't. He keeps entering my thoughts, and I have no control over it. This troubles me. But the fact that I'm troubled over it also in no way curbs my enthusiasm to dig. This guy has gotten more of my brain power, not that he asked for it, than my graduate degree, my acupuncture training, and the contents of my wardrobe all put together. And like an archaeologist, I have this idea that I will know more about him and somehow believe I will learn something of myself if I dig through his layers of discarded waste. So, trash can pulled out from under sink, hands in full excavation, a.k.a. pawing, mode. First, I stumble onto, you know, just garbage. Paper coffee filter with old grounds, a banana peel, some bits of salad, the cellophane from some fancy cheese. And then, a wine bottle. Now, that's moderately interesting. Apparently, he drank a whole bottle of wine, either on his own or with someone. Maybe some clues are just under this yogurt container, and yep, this is looking, what do we have? A condom. A condom? Okay, this refuse just got exponentially more interesting. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? I pull the thing out of the trash, touching it with as little of my finger's surface area as possible. I hold it up to the light to check for semen. I turn it this way, I turn it that, nope, nada, none that I can see. If only I had a microscope. Do I know anyone who owns a microscope? I mean, how pricey can they be? Do they sell microscopes at Target? Suddenly, nothing else I need to do with my day matters. I will get to the bottom of this. I lift the condom into a plastic bag. I'm a one-person forensic unit. Here is my Exhibit A to prove my point. Whatever that may be. I'm sure my point will focus on some fact with this trashy condom as evidence. My fact: I'm a way better human being. I'm kinder, more educated, more thoughtful, clearly a better investigator, better dresser. Somehow, I have this mistaken notion that finding this condom in my trash will, in the long run, make me feel better about myself. It's a lie. One part of myself tries to tell some other part of myself. The investigation must continue. I'm in my car. It's driving. My car is driving Isabel and me to his studio. What's wrong with me that I can't not know what's been going on in my house when it comes to this guy? It's sick that finding this sort of object is now intensely interesting. It's like I want to find something this sordid, this private. This physical urge to cut through the veil between us. And somehow, with a condom sealed in a plastic bag, which I will tuck tidily in the bottom drawer of that IKEA dresser my mother made me buy at 22, this will somehow make me feel oddly, twistedly closer. I wait outside his new workspace. "Hey," I say, feigning casual, "I've got to ask you something, and not here, in a more private place." He looks startled to see me at his shop. Okay, well, why don't you walk with me to my truck," he says. We walk to his blue International Harvester Scout. We get in his blue International Harvester Scout. I waste no time with chit-chat. "Listen, I was taking out the trash." In my own defense, in a matter of speaking, I was taking out the trash just with a little more attention to detail. I continue, and I big pause to look at him. His eyes wide. "And I found a condom, a used condom. And I have to, did you really have sex with someone in my house, in our old house?" He turns away and looks a little odd, this really awkward smile, more like a grimace. I wait. "Listen, Megan," another big pause. "It's not what you think." "What does he mean, not what I think? What else do you do with a condom? Hand puppet? Water balloon fight seems too obscure. It's not even warm out." He continues. "It's that I'm getting impatient. I kind of took your dildo and, you know." The rest of the sentence is, "placed it in my rectum, shoved it up my ass," but he can't utter the words. And here's the clincher, folks. This is why I'm definitely out on a limb here, showing you my worst. My response is not, "how dare you," or "you did what?" or "I don't think they were made to." Instead, I turn this right into, "sweetheart." I may not have used the word sweetheart, but it sounds truer that way. I say, "sweetheart, is this something we should have been doing? Something we needed to be doing?" He says nothing. He blushes. I think for a minute. Is he making this up? Is this really a preferable story in lieu of his possibly bringing a girl to the house? I focus on the technical aspects. I've lost my mind. "So you, let me get this straight. You took my dildo and put it up your ass?" I may not have used the word ass, you know, to be more sensitive. I may have opted for hand gestures. "And part of your plan, to be thoughtful, I take it, was to put a condom on it? Do I have this right?" "Look," he says, "must we go into this?" "Well, it is my dildo. I had forgotten it was even in my drawer." I try to say this with extreme gentleness, but hello, boundaries? I mean, should you maybe have started with something the size of that dildo? I know they sell these little pellet things. He wants to get off the topic. He asks me to lunch. I may be irrationally obsessed, but I draw the line at discussing stolen dildos placed in nearby rectums over Laird's go-to hot pork sandwich at Coconut Kenny's. I decline lunch, but I'm still trying to understand. "So were you, I don't know, on your back? Or did you turn on your side? I mean, were you successful?" He shakes me off. "No, it really wasn't all that successful." I'm trying to think how in the world this happens during a house-sitting gig. What is the thought process on this? I picture Laird sitting around my house thinking, nothing good on TV. No more wine. Let's see. It's too dark to take a walk. This book is boring. Maybe I'll get Megan's big blue dildo and... I don't know how fruitful it will be, but I definitely know what topic I'm bringing to therapy. But I won't bring the right questions to the session. I'm not yet discerning enough to ask, What am I doing rooting around in the trash to feel closer to another human being? Chapter 70, The Non-Therapist Therapist. Purpose. Cornelia is that non-therapist therapist I took to seeing once back in Bellingham. If Maji is a body-centered psychotherapist, Cornelia is a psychotherapy-focused body worker. Duration. Once a week. I think Tuesdays. Equipment needed. This is supposed to be body work with talk, but we rarely get on the table. Age, 35. Relationship status. Super sexy stalking sort of stuff. Cost, $100 an hour. There's a pattern here. Have you noticed? Location, Bellingham, Washington. I sit across from Cornelia, who looks like a little fireplug with Shirley Temple red hair, like a cute curly-topped tomato. I explain the other night's bush shenanigans, the shimmying past the garbage cans, the spider webs, the back-numbing hour on my knees, the stalking versus surveillance question, as well as digging through Laird's refuse. Like that. So then I sort of crawled out and headed back to my car and, Megan, this is stalking. You stalked. She talks to me in that voice you might use with mental patients or to talk somebody down off a ledge. I know what I did is bat guano bonkers, but she keeps talking like I don't. I'm going on vacation, so I'll make a deal with you. I'll give you my cell phone number if you go on antidepressants. Huh? But I don't think I'm I defend myself. Well, I don't think you realize how crazy this behavior is. First off, yes, I do. That's why I shared it. That scared me enough. I'm going to make sure that never happens again. And second, are even non-therapist therapists supposed to use the word crazy? This feels like some weird professional coercion, taking medication in exchange for a personal number. Meek and muddled by recent events, I take the phone number of a doctor she likes. I make an appointment. What have I just agreed to? I mean, what's so great about having her phone number again? Chapter 71. Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor, SSRI. Purpose. Get on an antidepressant as some weird deal to get Fireplug's phone number. Duration. They say it takes 6 weeks to get to a therapeutic dose. People usually take them for months or years, but it varies. Equipment needed. A prescription. SSRIs are believed to increase the extracellular level of the neurotransmitter serotonin, inhibiting its reuptake into the presynaptic cell, increasing the level of serotonin available to bind to the postsynaptic receptor. Age, a few days later. Relationship status. I talk to Coco on the phone a lot. Cost, $100 out of pocket. I only have crap catastrophic insurance, and this period, however catastrophic it might feel, doesn't qualify. Not to mention, I haven't met my deductible. Location, South Bellingham, Washington. Some doctor I've never met before, some medical complex to which I've never been. I just agreed to take an antidepressant on a whim suggested by an unlicensed therapist giving pharmaceutical advice. I think this doctor even deferred to me, let me diagnose myself. I read somewhere that Paxil was more about anxiousness, and I don't think I'm depressed, so that seems better. But what do I know? But I told Cornelia I'd do this, so I'll go with it. And this guy gives me the one I asked for. I'm pretty persuasive, even when I don't know what I'm talking about. Lucky me. And, because supposedly the drug won't show its effects for weeks, the doctor gives me a prescription of Xanax for the short term. Maybe this doctor isn't so bad after all. Cornelia gave me my first Xanax yesterday. I felt deliciously relaxed for 4 hours. So I'll start with the SSRI pills and shake this crazy. I'll drive east to Wyoming to climb the Grand, the grandest of the Tetons, for my summer vacation. Crazy or not, a timeout still seems prudent. Chapter 72, Olympic Therapy. My sick idea of a Maji combo platter vacation. Purpose. I'm ditching the Grand Teton climb due to my current cuckoo factor. Call it triage. Between the bush, the dildo, and these surges of anxiety, I need to nip this. Despite the breakup, I've asked Laird to join me after my therapy week with Majee for a couples intensive in Evergreen. Duration: 7 days. Equipment needed. It's a combo platter, really. A little acupuncture, a little EMDR. Age: same, same. Relationship status: beelining it to my besties. Employment: young acupuncturist on summer vacation. Cost: my business loan is getting used again. 4 sessions of 3 hours with breaks. Location: Niwot, Majee's office, Fort Collins, Coco's house, and Longmont, acupuncturist's office, Colorado. I hope to be successfully reprogrammed. I'm not sure what this means exactly, but it sounds right. When I was little, I never thought getting reprogrammed would be one of my life goals. But neither did I imagine I'd become insane, scary person taking to hiding in shrubs and digging in garbage. The unabating nausea only rises. I'm now losing a pound every 2 days with a wonderful burning pain under my sternum. This is stress on steroids, and I'm plagued by obsessive thoughts. Fantastic. I've bailed on the Teton climb. I thought climbing the Grand in my state was as intelligent as heading into oncoming traffic. I head to Coco's instead, my de facto command central, to de-nutter myself. Coco greets me at her front door. Usually, she would throw open her screen door with a sunburst of welcome like, ta-da! Instead, upon seeing the yellow, skinnier nut job, she pauses, trying to take in the hot mess before her. Come on in. Her large, normally happy eyes squinch with concern. She lingers at the door to watch me sort of drag in. I can feel her eyes on my back. I think she's just put on her invisible clinical hat to inspect who, or what, I've dropped in her lap unasked. Can I get you some tea? She shuffles about the kitchen and draws a glass of the nettle tea she's been brewing in the backyard. I can't be bothered with tea. The most obvious conclusion: I am simply going crazy. I want semi-easily amused, mostly collected Megan back. I have 7 days. A tall order. Nut job is really only capable of the following thoughts. Where is he? I wonder what he's doing right now. Is he with her? I wonder what they're doing. I wonder if they're having sex right now. I wonder if he likes it. I wonder if he thinks of me. I wonder if he'll really come to the couples counseling here. I wonder what couples counseling will be like. I wonder what they're doing. I wonder if he's having fun without me. I wonder if they're having fun. What's he? Blah, blah, blah. Nutjob was a real bore. Nutjob needed to be taken down, iced, eliminated, taken out back and shot. Worse still, the Paxil wasn't cutting it. Nutjob was like a house on fire, a 3-alarm fire. Unfortunately, those next days, Coco had to spend the bulk of the time she would have liked to spend with Megan with Nutjob instead. Megan and Nutjob would spend part of the day in therapy, then come home to Coco's house without Nutjob because magic Majee time was effective. But somehow, Nutjob would descend upon everybody again. Nutjob didn't like to be alone. Ever. If Coco was in the kitchen, Nutjob was in the kitchen. If Coco was at the computer, Nutjob would pull up a chair. When Coco had to go to the bathroom, Nutjob would follow her and sit on the tub. Nutjob continued. Where is he? I wonder what he... Is he with... Should Laird arrive in 4 more days for the passionate marriage intensive Megan had invited him to before departing, a last-ditch effort after sending him a pizza and having sex with him, knowing he was also seeing Miss Nobody Else, it would take a miracle to get Nutjob to calm the fuck down. When she wasn't cyclically droning on about his physical whereabouts, Nutjob spent a tremendous amount of time waxing rhapsodic about his penis. Coco, I don't think you understand. It's so beautiful. Sob, sob, sob. I love it. So sexy. Sob, sob. The way it curves to the right. Will I ever see it again?
Will I? Seriously, you don't understand. His penis! Nutjob dropping to the floor, knees to chest. The way it banked toward his leg. I love it. I miss it. Now rolling, wailing, full fetal. Nutjob felt it absolutely necessary to craft the right email to review logistics for Laird's arrival. Short, to the point, cool. A literal three-line email, Nutjob chose the words like it was an addendum to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Nutjob roped Coco into reviewing it. Do you think I'm clinging with my use of the word you in that first sentence? Should I say dear or hello or just hey? Maybe I should say, hey there. That's what he says. Nutjob needed to be sure they were the right three sentences, the right comma placement, intimating the right inflection. A misplaced dash could prove disastrous. Chapter 73, Depossession, The Dragon's Treatment. Purpose. It's very hush-hush in the five-element acupuncture world. We're taught to do it prior to a standard treatment when signs indicate. Failing to do dragons when needed can prevent treatment from proceeding successfully.